Blog Talk Radio.
Ron Edwards. This is the Don and Ron Show, coming to you from the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Happy belated New Year's on this, the 6th day of January in the year of our Lord, 2016, if you will. We have a lot of things to take a look at tonight. Our co-host, Don Allen, will not be with us. In fact, Don will probably not be with us through the entire month of January. He has some ongoing obligations and commitments, and we probably will not be hearing from Don until our first Wednesday in February. But this is the holiday occasion, if you will. We see it as something else. We see it as the month of January, enjoying the rich history of Martin Luther King Jr., a martyr, if you will, a man who did much to, quote-unquote, shape this nation and its dialogue and reflections as it pertains to the issue of race, civil rights, and et cetera. A lot of things going on across the country, across the world. In fact, we want to touch on the announcement by North Korea that it has developed and detonated a hydrogen bomb, one of the most powerful, if you will, instruments of destruction and death. Many so-called American experts are trying to say they doubt that the little yellow man of North Korea have the ability to do that, but these are the same people that were saying over a decade ago that the North Koreans didn't have the ability to develop nuclear devices. In fact, these are the same people, to some degree, that were saying the same thing 30 years ago about the Chinese and their inability to become a nuclear power, if you will. If, in fact, the North Koreans have perfected a hydrogen bomb and are ultimately able to redesign it so that it fits on the tip of a ballistic missile, there's all kinds of worries in a lot of different places around the world, including here in the United States. But it is interesting, the timing of the North Korean government. Of course, the United States already attempting to apply pressure to China, who some say is the only friend that the North Koreans have in this big entire world of ours. Of course, we know that isn't accurate either, but it sounds good for purposes of propaganda. Oh, yes, yes, yes. We here in the United States of America and the Western world practice propaganda just like everyone else. A lot of discussion about terrorism, if you will. In fact, this enclave that we are broadcasting from, the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, has been designated as one of the most dangerous places in the United States with respect to recruitment and planning, if you will, for possible both international and domestic terrorism. Oh, we're not supposed to talk about that. But this program is about laying out the most factual information that we possibly can gather. Oh, yes, for those of you that have tuned in, we will not be taking phone calls this evening, but we will be talking in terms of a number of local issues, including a very interesting membership meeting of the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP last night in North Minneapolis. People are indicating that they're not getting a lot of information and et cetera. Of course, there was a competing event at the UROC, University of Minnesota facility on Plymouth Avenue, just across Kitty Carter from the Urban League of Minneapolis. Some say as many as 200 people were at that location, the UROC, as opposed to maybe 25 to 30 at the NAACP meeting at a former bank facility in North Minneapolis. But first of all, I want to take a look at some other events, national events. We've touched on the most significant discussed international event just a couple minutes ago, and that is that the North Koreans have carried out their fourth nuclear experiment, explosion test, if you will, in 10 years. And as we said just minutes ago, this comes at a time when certainly everyone is concerned about terrorism conflict now between Iran and Saudi Arabia after the death of a Shiite cleric, a very popular individual in Saudi Arabia. But the Saudi Arabian government, which is actually one of the most repressive governments in the world, and are really renowned for their method of execution, one of the few countries still in the so-called civilized world that still beheads people. That's why I was kind of interested in how upset people were about Jihadi John, if you will. You remember him, who allegedly was killed during a drone attack about a couple months ago. But we understand that folks can take on the persona of, you know, fakeism, if you will, contradictions, hypocrisy, and et cetera. But we must always keep in mind the actual rendering of discipline in the so-called royal kingdom, that being Saudi Arabia, beheadings, if you will. But it is a situation to keep your eye on. Both countries are clearly military powers in that part of the world. The Iranians probably more so. The Iranians clearly much more tested, particularly with the Revolutionary Guard, in the art of war, if you will, conflict, and et cetera. Revolutionary Guard certainly very much has been very much involved in conflicts in other parts of the Middle East, if you will, Iraq, Syria, certainly putting together Hezbollah as a significant military power in Lebanon, and et cetera. And so you keep your eye on all of that, understanding that this is 2016. This is an election year, a presidential election year. And all of the candidates now, both Democrat, Republicans, and I guess whatever independents are out there, who are really getting serious, if you will. Donald Trump and Republicans talking about the bedroom manner of former President Bill Clinton of Arkansas, if you will. I'm not sure that I do not understand how people are pretending to be surprised that the issue of his quote-unquote conduct, if you will, while President of the United States, would not become a topic of political discussion. And certainly I'm quite sure that former President Clinton, who is a pretty intelligent man with a good understanding and a good depth of what happens in the political arena, has certainly anticipated that. And certainly his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, who is running to receive the Democratic nomination to run for president of these United States, certainly expected that Monica Lewinsky, the legacy of Monica Lewinsky, who is living somewhere in the United States now, a quiet life and et cetera, would reemerge along with Mrs. Jones and some others. For those of you who have forgotten the Clinton legacy 15 years ago or a tad longer, but those are all a part of the American political landscape, if you will. For those that feel that American politics is not dirty, unethical, and et cetera, then clearly you've been on another planet and you need immediate assistance and immediate help with regards to understanding just how ugly and nasty the 2016 election for the office of President of the United States is going to be. So we certainly watch closely as a political commentator, as a historian, etc., to that aspect of what is going on. Now, we have a tad of terrorism going on in the United States. No, it's not the Muslims, if you will. It's not the little brown people, if you will, that have come here or have ties, if you will, and heritage in the quote-unquote Middle East or Black Africa, be it East or West Africa, and etc. No, it is in a place probably not familiar to many of you. It's called Burns, Oregon. Beautiful little town in a very beautiful part of America and a very beautiful part of the state of Oregon. We reflect on it in our column in next week's edition of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest black newspaper in the state of Minnesota. Burns, Oregon, over the last 6 days has caught the attention of the world, really, because I know that many in the so-called sophisticated industrialized nations, that basically means the white nations of Europe and the United States and Canada, are watching to see what the United States government will do with regards to the seizure of federal property, though the government owns 53% or a little bit better of the land in the state of Oregon, if you will. But Burns, Oregon, a little town of about 2,806 citizens, if you will. There may be a couple of Native Americans in the immediate vicinity. By the way, Burns, Oregon, is situated in the largest county in the state of Oregon and the ninth largest county in the United States of America, if you will. Big, big, big county. For those of you that are trying to fathom what it is we're saying, think in terms of St. Louis County in the far northern reaches of northern Minnesota along Lake Superior. Largest city, the city of Duluth, if you will. St. Louis County, a very, very large county. Makes you wonder how they administrated and provide services to the citizens and the taxpayers of St. Louis County and et cetera. Certainly, we hope that we are coming clear to our listening audience tonight. In fact, I have a couple people to kind of give me a text, if you will, if you're receiving the broadcast with the necessary clarity that is important, particularly in that we'll be talking about the local scene, specifically the NAACP, which has become a significant presence here in the city of Minneapolis and the Twin Cities, if you will. But we want to go back to Oregon for a moment because of the presence of armed militia, white militia. No, not Al Jazeera or Al-Qaeda, if you will, or ISIS or et cetera. No, these are the white militia that we oftentimes have talked about on these programs over the last many years. Some of my homeboys, if you will, have come down from places like Sandpoint, Idaho, from their training facilities there along the Spirit River and Spirit Lake there in the far, far north of Idaho. Beautiful, beautiful country up there also, and excellent, you know, situation and excellent coverage, if you will, for military-style survivalist camps and et cetera. We've talked about that. In fact, we've talked about it quite a bit after the outrageous massacre at Mother Emanuel A&E Church in Charleston, South Carolina. By the way, on that particular note, as we move and deal with many different items on tonight's program, the police officer who shot and killed Walter Scott, an African-American, for those of you that either have forgotten it or want to pretend that you've forgotten it, particularly of the so-called liberal persuasion. Walter Scott was shot 8 times in the back, captured on film, not by any commercial photographer, et cetera, but by a good citizen who was brave enough to record the execution of Mr. Scott on a bright bright summer day in Charleston, excuse me, North Charleston, really, North Charleston, which is a city separate from Charleston. The police officer, Mr. Sager, I believe is how the name is pronounced, has been released on bail, was able to post a $100,000 bail. I don't know how you get bail in a situation in which you so cold-bloodedly shot and killed a human being in such a cold-blooded manner, when in fact the man was fleeing for his life, if you will, and then attempted to plant a weapon, a taser, next to his body, and then filed a report, in fact perjuring yourself. By the way, on the question of perjury, the public safety officer, highway patrolman down there in Texas, with regards to Miss Bland, you remember Miss Bland, don't you? Those of us in the United States, in the black community, and certainly our listening audience, Miss Bland was the African-American woman stopped on a rather questionable traffic stop who allegedly committed suicide in the Texas jail, if you will, where the highway patrolman that stopped her and pulled her from the car and threw her to the ground and et cetera, which certainly created a significant emotional state for her, was indicted yesterday by a Texas grand jury for perjury because the good white highway patrolman lied when he gave testimony to a grand jury with regards to all of the circumstances surrounding the stop and the ultimate arrest of Miss Bland, a young African-American woman from Chicago who had just moved to that Texas town, if you will, where one of the more prestigious black universities is located, to begin a new job. The Texas public safety officer was kind of, I guess, saying, welcome to Texas. Well, you know, that's another story. Oh, by the way, back to, as we said before, in Charleston, or North Charleston, South Carolina, the patrol officer who was captured on film, just shooting Mr. Scott in the back 8 times, cold-blooded, as Mr. Scott ran away from him, representing no threat and et cetera. But, you know, you have to understand that you can use deadly force under any circumstances as long as your intended target, later to be victim, is a African-American, if you will. And so the officer has been released on bail, and I guess in order to satisfy the outrage within the African-American community throughout South Carolina and other places in the South, have indicated that he will be under house arrest, if you will. I noticed they never said anything about the fact that he is a possible flight to, quote-unquote, flee and et cetera. In other words, a risk. But anyways, he got bail. Can't you envision a black police officer who shot down a Caucasian citizen, unarmed, if you will, captured on film, shot him 8 times in the back? Oh, that's right. We already have a situation like that. Well, not a black one, but could you imagine a black police officer being let out on bail? But, you know, the pattern is here. Look at Chicago. We have a white officer there, shoots a African-American who had a small knife, but the video there showed the African-American walking away from the officer, not threatening him, but he was shot, 16 times. And in fact, if not for the insistence of his comrades, another 7 officers that were with him that night, the white officer, he was getting ready to put another clip in his Glock 9mm pistol. I guess he was just going to make target practice out of the young man. Was it Mr. McDonald? Yeah. So this is, as we prepare for 2016, getting ready in America, with a lot of volatility, if you will. And so that brings us back to, we haven't forgotten it, Burns, our Oregon, if you will, a very, very white town and a very, very white part of a pretty much white state, Oregon. For those of you that have been there, you know what we're talking about. largest city in Oregon, Portland, Oregon, which has a small African-American population, if you will. Basically, African-Americans are pretty much welcome in Oregon if they can play football and basketball, if you know what I mean. Oregon, Oregon State, even Portland State, if you will. Welcome African-American, you know, as long as they can shoot the basketball, catch the football, tackle, and et cetera. So we kind of understand what Oregon is about. But to this group of individuals that have shown up and actually taken control of this little town of 2,800 white citizens are apparently not being welcomed by the citizens of that particular town, who are more concerned about two ranchers by the name of Hammonds, the Hammond family, father and son, who have been sent back to a federal corrections facility in Northern California after, and this is kind of interesting because it certainly represents double jeopardy, after serving the initial terms that they had been sentenced to by a federal judge in Oregon. Another federal judge, made the determination that there had been a mistake in the sentencing guidelines and that both father and son, the Hammonds, should have received at least 4 to 5 years, if you will, and ordered them rearrested and, as we said just seconds ago, sent to a corrections facility in Northern California, from Oregon. And so what this has led to is the arrival of a whole host of white militia, if you will, fully armed, if you will. I mean, they have the camouflage fatigues and et cetera, are carrying the vest of weapons and et cetera, and clearly indicating that they are ready to do battle with the government of the United States. Now, they're not the kind of people that just boast, because many of us still remember Ruby Ridge. And then, of course, we remember how our government does, if we remember places like Waco and Philadelphia, for those that sometimes pretend that they've lost focus, if you will, cannot remember what it was that happened and when it happened. And so, and let us use now this particular term and see how it catches people. These white terrorists, if you will, who have taken control of this small little town in the southeastern part of Oregon, and have indicated that they are prepared to do battle with the federal government. I mean, of course, they know they've got no out, no win situation. But given what America has began to expose as the onion is being peeled back, particularly driven by Donald Trump and others. And by the way, Donald Trump has really jumped on the senator from Texas, Mr. Cruz, Senator Cruz, about the fact that he may be caught up in that birthers situation. You remember the birthers thing, don't you? That was when people were quite comfortable indicating that Barack Obama was not an American citizen. In fact, they were saying that because his dad, his father, who was a Kenyan, President Barack Obama, was in some way or another in violation of some aspect of the Constitution. I find it interesting in the great debate that started today about the issue of birther as it pertains to Senator Cruz, that the declaration now is that Senator Cruz's mother was a natural-born American, and so consequently the court should rule that makes him an American, eligible for citizenship and et cetera. Well, if I remember correctly, President Barack Obama's mother, who was white, was a full-born, quote-unquote, naturalized American citizen, and yet I never heard that argument made by the conservative to right, if you will. Now, that takes us back to Oregon, where I see a kind of a different standard. Let me say it to you like this. If a bunch of homeboys had decided to come down from Portland, which is about 284 miles northwest of Burns, Oregon, and maybe a couple of their homeboys, about 20 or 25, had decided to drive up from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and about 50 or 60 black men in camouflage uniforms carrying AR-15s, AR-16s, automatic weapons, and et cetera, descended upon that town and its 2,806 citizens and took over a federal building, took occupancy in, you know, the couple of motels there in Burns, Oregon, and et cetera. I'm quite sure the National Guard, number one, supported by federal troops, airborne, if you will, special forces, and et cetera, would already be in play. And those African Americans would have already been in custody. And many commentators would be screaming and hollering that Black America is now beginning to embrace, quote unquote, terrorism and needs to be watched. And Donald Trump may talk in terms of building fences around the, quote unquote, urban ghettos of America. I mean, think about it, my friends, because no one is really discussing it. It's amazing that that these individuals, these Caucasian militia, and by the way, they, I mean, they are dangerous. In fact, Dylan Root, the man who massacred 9 African Americans at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, is a member of a couple of Pacific militia groups, if you will. And of course, his manifesto, you know, everybody writes a manifesto, clearly indicated his thinking, Mr. Root's thinking and philosophy with respect to the right of the African American to live in relevant peace and harmony and safety. Safety maybe being the operative word with regards to our protection under the Constitution and et cetera. So we watch closely as a journalist and as a historian how the situation in southeastern Oregon is really going to be handled. These militia, these white terrorists, if you will, have indicated that they intend they took a page right out of the Black Book, by any means necessary, to protect their constitutional rights. The Hammond family, the father and son, have kind of backed away. In fact, they surrendered yesterday to federal authorities and were transported to a minimum, by the way, minimum facility in Northern California, as we said just a couple of minutes ago. But we have a different standard in America, and no one wants to use the word in identifying these Caucasian gunmen, if you will, as terrorists, just as there was great, great, great difficulty in identifying, if you will, Dylan Root as a white terrorist, murderer, if you will, executioner in a holy place of African Americans, both men and women, if you will. There was just great difficulty with being able to do that. And so it just further illustrates the fact that there is a double system in our beloved country, if you will. There's a double standard, if you will. There's even a double set of laws as it pertains to the sons and daughters of the African. Again, it's not something we're supposed to talk about, but that's why we are blessed to have a program that, you know, can be listened to help remind folks, particularly in that this is, as we said at the top of this program, this is the month of the history, the birth, and unfortunately, though he died in April of 1968, that this is also represents the death, the tragic assassination, the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee. Again, something that we're not supposed to talk about, if you will. You know, it's always a situation when black folk are the targets of assassinations and et cetera. It's never a conspiracy. Everybody's always a lone wolf. when there's even an inkling that there may be a possibility of some retaliation or there was some kind of planning or et cetera, and we used to see this a lot in the 1960s, that it was a massive conspiracy by the entire nation of black people, if you will, and every Negro represents a security threat to, quote-unquote, the stability and the safety of the United States of America. In fact, we will make a recommendation in reference to a book called The Man Who Cried I Am. Heck of a book. A lot of people think that it's fiction. It's not fiction. It is a true illustration that came about as the outgrowth of documents that were made available by the then congressman from Harlem and also a ordained minister of the Ebenezer Church in Harlem, Reverend Slash, U.S. Representative Adam Clayton Powell, a great, great, great black American, a man who tried to warn the African-American community, black American, etc., what was coming. In fact, if it had not been for the book, The Man Who Cried I Am, I'm not sure that many of us would be around here to talk about anything because the concentration camps were being readied. And for those of you out there too young to know and remember who say, you know, how dare this commentator refer to concentration camps in America, ask Japanese Americans about that terrible period from January 1942 to the end of the conflict in April of 1945, when individuals, some who had children that were born here in the United States, if you will, in some situations, adult Japanese Americans, Nisi, as they were called, who were themselves born and raised here in the United States of America, who found themselves in concentration camps. In fact, we had a very, quote-unquote, desolated kind of down in the bottoms along the Minnesota River, right here in our beloved Minnesota, great liberal Minnesota, down around a couple towns called Savage. That's an interesting name, Savage and Shakopee, Minnesota. And if it's not for the Japanese American community in this state, we would all try to play like we didn't know anything about that and didn't remember that. But that's for those that like to think that such kinds of draconian operations and draconian history and et cetera doesn't exist. Oh, by the way, for those of you that are followers and did follow the incarceration of Japanese Americans during the Second World War, didn't do the same thing to the Germans or the Italians. I wonder why. But the martial law administrator, we always remind ourselves and periodically on our television program here from the Twin Cities, we take time to remind people that the martial law administrator during that particular period who ordered the roundup of Japanese Americans from their homes, took their businesses, their bank accounts, and et cetera. In fact, it took 50 years for the Congress to provide some compensation, if you will, for the properties and the businesses and et cetera, was a man by the name of Earl Warren, who became a great Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. In fact, he presided over a case which is important and talked about by black historians, and that was the case of Brown versus Topeka, if you will, a very courageous young African-American woman, Miss Brown, who took on the school district of Topeka, Kansas, for the right in the 1950s of the Negro, quote-unquote, to have equal education. Oops. and with a excellent attorney by the name of Thurgood Marshall, convinced the Supreme Court that separate but equal was not the law of the land. that history is interesting within itself. It's also part of the reason that people are confused and do not understand that slavery and segregation are not one and the same, if you will. And maybe later on this month on this program, as we said, our associate, Mr. Allen, our co-host, will probably not be with us during the month of January. And so, consequently, we will take a look at different aspects of those things that that had to do and have to do with the existence and the battle that was fought by the sons and daughters of the African as far back as the 1600s, 1500s, if you will, on this continent. That then leads us to the current condition and circumstances here in our own beloved Twin Cities, if you will, at the headwaters of the Mississippi River. As we said last night, and we know that there are folks out there kind of waiting for the reflections. The NAACP had its monthly meeting, and attended by, I don't know, about 28, 29 people, according to any number of sources. There was nothing in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, though there was a piece in there about the man who was attempting to be the superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools while he is under criminal investigation in Massachusetts. That's going to be interesting. At least the Board of Education here broke off negotiations with Mr. Paws. And by the way, I don't know that they refer to him as Dr. Paws. I assume that he has a doctor's degree in some discipline, hopefully education, if you will. I also hope that he has a license to be a superintendent, as is required by Minnesota law. But we know all that will be taken care of at some point in time. But the NAACP was paid a visit last night, we understand, by the man seeking to be the superintendent of the Minneapolis Public Schools, a district much larger than anything that he's ever come close to. In fact, I think that his only experience in public education as a superintendent was in a small school district of 11 schools in western Massachusetts, in which two of those schools was under direct supervision of the state of Massachusetts because of abuse and other kinds of violations inconsistent with, quote-unquote, the constitutional guarantees provided by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, if you will, to its citizens in that small western Massachusetts town just north of Springfield, Massachusetts, for those that may be interested, Hollylock, as they refer to it. But it was the awaiting, if you will, the anticipation that the NAACP of Minneapolis was going to put on the agenda last night and discuss the announcement that it was calling for a boycott, yes, boycott, of MOA, which is the abbreviation for the Mall of America, if you will. There's been conflict between Black Lives Matter, NAACP of Minneapolis, and the city of Bloomington, the city attorney of Bloomington, the Hennepin County District Court, and, of course, more importantly, the Mall of America, a very well-organized American corporation owned by foreigners. But anyways, that is, in some regards, is for another time. But the boycott was not on the agenda, and we are certainly puzzled by that, because we expected that at least the branch would have to put that on the agenda and to place the proposition before the general membership of the NAACP. The NAACP is a membership organization. To have the general membership say aye or nay, or nay or aye, if you will, in regards to the call for a boycott. See, the problem with a boycott is that organizations like the NAACP cannot be involved in boycotts, if you will, particularly an organization that does not have any bonding or any insurance, if, in fact, they should be countersued by the individual corporation or business or entity, if you will, legal entity that is talking about boycotting and et cetera. Now, the term selective buying would be legally much more appropriate, if you will, than something called boycott. But the word is out that, though the national NAACP in Baltimore is extremely annoyed at the fact that boycott was used, and by extension has created a serious legal problem for the NAACP of Minneapolis, as well as the state conference NAACP under the leadership of W.C. Jordan of Rochester, Minnesota, who is also the president of the Rochester branch, as well as president of the Minnesota Dakota, and that's the proper name, Minnesota Dakota branch of the NAACP. And it calls for, particularly in light of the 18-day occupation of the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis, the 4th Precinct of the MPD, it's the Minneapolis Police Department, there didn't seem to be much discussion either at this January meeting, first meeting of the year, as it pertains to what happened, how it happened, and what all the circumstances are. Now, we assume that there is still a significant interest in the death of a young African-American, 24-year-old African-American by the name of Jamar Clark in North Minneapolis, just about a block and a half, two blocks from the 4th Precinct. We assume that that's still in play. Everyone is still awaiting the completion of the investigation by two agencies, separate but working together jointly on this investigation, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and certainly the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Of course, they will complete the investigation in their own good time. We understand that at last night's meeting of the NAACP Minneapolis branch, they requested a certain procedure and structure be set up by County Attorney Mike Freeman and then be paid for by both the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County. I'm not sure how that's supposed to work. Once again, do these organizations, particularly after a disastrous meeting with Governor Mark Dayton about 10 days ago, I mean, do these organizations have the fiduciary liability in place? In the case of the meeting with the governor about a week ago, they demanded a $100 million. Of course, the governor, who is not a stupid man, if you will, suggested that, you know, they needed to have a proposal. You know, that's always important when you're going to ask for that kind of money. You know, even if you go to the bank and you ask for a couple hundred dollars, the man's going to ask you what you're going to do with it, what you need it for. Governor Mark Dayton asked the group that was gathered, a combination of Black Lives Matter and the NAACP of Minneapolis and the state conference and et cetera, and lo and behold, to the embarrassment of the memory and recollection of those who were involved with successful civil rights activities and et cetera, going back to 1909, the brothers and sisters gathered there said they didn't have no proposal, didn't need no proposal. The governor said you need to go talk to your legislative representatives and suggested, because of the complexion, if you will, of the organizations, that they needed to talk to their two black state senators specifically. And the governor indicated that he does not allocate the money, that under the Minnesota Constitution, that's done by the legislature. But it is kind of our understanding that at some point in this discussion that it was basically stated that, you know, constitutional presence and constitutional requirements and et cetera just got to be set aside, if you will, because these people are these people, whatever that's supposed to mean. Of course, that doesn't sit well with folks who believe in the rule of law, but it appears that in again, circumstances in which Black Lives Matter and the NAACP's that the rule of law doesn't matter if it. And see, it's the same thing that got them really started, really got them all pumped up, and that was they talked about poverty pimps, if you will. And you know, you begin to wonder where one poverty pimp begins and where the other poverty pimp ends, and vice versa, if you know what I mean. And so I'm not sure on who it is that, if these folks ever get any money, who will actually have the fiduciary responsibility, who will make sure that everything is appropriately taken care of, and et cetera. Now, we know that the Headwaters Foundation, which is one of the smaller foundations here in the Twin Cities, who fund liberal causes, if you will, had originally announced about almost 3 weeks ago that they were going to, and maybe a little bit longer, that they were awarding initially the press release given to Minnesota Public Radio, NPR, indicated three entities, NOC, which used to be the Acorn Group. They had to change their names because of some political situations. They became Neighborhood Organization, NOC, Black Lives Matter, and the Minneapolis NAACP. Then the reference to the organizations changed, and it was just supposed to be Black Lives Matter. Now, this has all been documented and et cetera. And, in fact, it was part of the discussion and the reflections with Governor Dayton and his staff, his senior staff, and the representatives of the two organizations met with the governor at the governor's mansion. In fact, one of the things that happened was that the president of the NAACP, who was vacationing in California. Man, it must have been nice because it was starting to get cold back here in the Twin Cities, was denied the opportunity to participate in a discussion by the governor, who maintained that he was not in the habit of involving himself in these kinds of conversations and reflections on conference calls, that just didn't meet the criteria, if you will, for protecting the interest of all parties concerned. And I think that that's kind of appropriate. And so the president of the NAACP, who is an instructor at one of our more prestigious private colleges here in the Twin Cities, St. Thomas, was cut off. And in fact, I think it's what caused her to be returning to the Twin Cities about 36 hours later, and then was at a incident at Mall of America, which led to the call for the boycott of Mall of America when it was stated that a 14-year-old African-American girl had been set upon and brutalized by security guards at Mall of America. In fact, initially, in their initial reports and discussions with the Star Tribune, the organizations Mall of America said that Mall of America and the Bloomington Police Department were involved in the arrest and the brutality. In that newspaper article last Friday, written by a reporter by the name of David Chinnan, it was quite clear, according to the Bloomington police, that they were not on the scene, were not involved in any shape, form, or fashion, if you will. So we expect that there will probably be some kind of lawsuit, if you will. We assume that attorneys are being prepared because, just prior to the Minnesota-Dakota conference, NAACP conference in St. Paul a couple Saturdays ago, there had been discussion via emails, text messages, and et cetera, that the NAACP president wanted to retain the services of the American Civil Liberties Union to represent them in a number of lawsuits and et cetera. The only problem is the Constitution and bylaws, you know, that's always important. The NAACP does not allow that. In fact, if you seek any kind of outside legal counsel, you will seek the counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which is different and separate from the NAACP Inc., if you will. But I assume that very knowledgeable people know that, and I'm quite sure that they don't need to hear from any old-timer. such as this commentator as an example, who would at least attempt to enlighten them about what the rules of engagement has a tendency to be. Now, that takes us back to last night as we move into the last 10 minutes of tonight's program. Last night, like I said, there was great anticipation that there would be discussion about the boycott. There would be certainly discussion about, you know, what kinds of updates there were as it pertains to the tragic death of Mr. Clark, shot down on the streets of Minneapolis in mid-November. That did not seem to play out. There was some discussion about, does, as we said earlier on this program, does the NAACP, as it moves forward with quote-unquote contesting and doing battle and et cetera, does it have the necessary fiduciary protection like insurance and bonding and et cetera to make sure that if the organization is sued, that each and every member of record on the occasion of the event are protected, if you will, from liability. That's always important. And for those of you that are extremely smart out there, and I know that, you know, no one really can tell you what it is that you should be making yourself knowledgeable of, might want to research that. You know, one of the best places to research it is in law books. And in searching the law books, you take a look at what is called precedent. Precedent meaning those things that have come before you became aware of it, in which decisions were made relevant to the exercise of legality and the quest for quote-unquote justice and et cetera. Need to take a look, maybe spend a little time down there at the law library at the Hennepin County Government Center, even to go down and take a look at maybe a couple of law books at the Minneapolis Library. You know, talk to some of your friends in the legal world and et cetera. You know, that probably would be extremely important that you do that so that you get a real good feel about what latitude you have, because, again, a lot of folks were surprised last night that the item and the issue of boycott, because of the implications that it carries for the organization and its fiduciary future, I repeat that again, its fiduciary future, is of such paramount importance. And for the item not to be an item of the agenda, you know what I'm saying? Kind of makes you wonder, you know, who is, you know, steering the ship, if you will, making sure that what needs to be done is done in the best interest of the community and the sons and daughters of the African, and not in the best interest of a select group. I was told an interesting story in a conversation just this past Saturday with a young minister who is also a businessman, who was saying that when some of you came back from the press conference in the rotunda of City Hall in Minneapolis, that you were talking about not the 14-year-old young lady or the allegations against Mall of America, you were talking about the fact that your picture was in the paper. And I think that, you know, in many respects, that is so narrow-minded, if you will. That is so indicative of everything that is contrary to the spirit of the civil rights movement and et cetera. But, of course, as we've been told, that we need not talk about history or have any knowledge of history. History is not important. What is important is this, quote-unquote, them, us. If you will. Now, let me just say this in the last 5 minutes of tonight's program. Two groups have not forgotten how they were treated during the occupation and during the period leading up to the occupation and during the occupation and since the occupation. And that is the African-American ministers, the senior pastors, the ones who have churches that function and work, if you will. And most importantly, our fire and police, protective services personnel who are black. You know, nobody wants to deal with the kind of threats and insults that were hurled at African American ministers and et cetera, and also that were hurled at African American firefighters and police officers, particularly in the vicinity of the 4th Precinct, and et cetera. And I know it's easy to say, you know, they don't trust the authorities and the fire department, et cetera. And yet, and let me give you an example as we close. There was a terrible incident just before Christmas. There are some of you out there that know about it, but you're scared to say anything about it, particularly those of you that say that you're about the business of education. The principal at one of our public high schools or facilities in North Minneapolis, right there on Glenwood, was severely beaten and attacked by students. Kind of reminded you of what's going on over in St. Paul. And she was quite concerned about the fact that she wanted to file charges against those that attacked her and other members of her staff, if you will. Security personnel who were present in the school on the occasion of this incident just before Christmas basically stood down and indicated that though there are a couple of Minneapolis police officers off duty who work security at the school, that they wanted the police called and these African American students arrested, if you will, for their conduct and assaults and et cetera. And since that time, and this reminded me of a meeting in December of the NAACP when white gunmen, some of the same ones that shot 5 African-Americans down on the streets of Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, in mid-November, became fearful of the presence of Caucasian gunmen, if you will, militia type there in the meeting there on the first Tuesday of December, if you will, and actually sought out individuals to call the Minneapolis Police Department in the 4th Precinct to provide protection. Now, in closing, I'm just trying to figure out how the reconciliation with black ministers and black law enforcement and firefighters is going to take place, because I've raised the question in a conversation over the last couple of days, and I asked the question of both fire and police personnel of African American, you know, heritage, if anyone had reached out to them to apologize or to certainly talk in terms of reconciliation. See, I was present at a meeting at the Urban League when the statement was made that there will never be reconciliation. There are people that are unworthy of reconciliation and et cetera. And I thought, wow, that's really narrow, if you will. That seems to be certainly inconsistent with what true leadership, effective leadership, is really all about. You know, I don't think that we have the luxury as black America or black Minneapolitans to reject, push away, deny the importance of reconciliation, if you will. But then there are some people who are so omnipotent to themselves that they feel that they can do it on their own, and they certainly do not need, quote-unquote, the presence, if you will, and the support of the community. And as was said in that meeting at the Urban League a couple weeks ago, there are people that they maintain they will never sit down with. Well, when people say that, they tend to forget in closing, there are people who hold and subscribe to the same doctrine. Just like you don't want to sit down with people, there are people that don't want to sit down with you. And as long as you're at that kind of loggerheads, you know, and you are in a situation where you're locked in to a suicide dive, if you will, then nothing will ever change. Well, thank you. Next week, we're going to take an in-depth look at the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s and the beloved Martin Luther King Jr., a man who gave his life. so that black Americans could at least have a chance to continue to fight for our freedom and our future. On behalf of my co-host, we wish you the best. Try to be safe, because there's still a lot of violence out on the streets. On behalf of Mr. Allard and myself, I'll be talking to you again next week. I'm Ron Edwards. This is the Ron and Don Show. Good evening. Thank you.